listening to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
You're listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm Victor Benitez, a librarian with the labs at the Shaw Library. Today we present So Tent Stories with Anu Yadav, the D.C. Public Library's Artist in Residence this year. Anu is also an actress, playwright, and theater-based educator. She is a D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities Artist Fellow and Alternate Roots Grantee. She is a member of the Actors Equity Association, Dramatists Guild, Alternate Roots, Network of Ensemble Theaters, and the Poor People's Campaign. Anu, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
That's great to hear you, Anu. For everyone tuning in, Anu is on the phone with us. So how are you today, Anu?
I'm doing well, yeah.
That's great.
Doing very well.
Well, before we dive right into So Tent Stories, I just wanted to give you a chance to introduce yourself a little bit more. Where are you from and where are you calling from right now?
Well, I was originally from Iowa, and then we moved to Kansas, so I spent a good part of my childhood in the Midwest.
Okay.
And I've been on the East Coast in D.C. For a number of years. I'm actually in Los Angeles right now.
Okay.
Calling from there. I've been doing a bunch of travel as kind of a freelance artist and actress. So that has me kind of jetting around.
Yes,
sometimes.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of your work is acting and in plays and doing theater. How did you first get into acting?
Well, you know, I've always really enjoyed it. And I don't know, I think other people also have those kinds of stories of like when you were a young child and you kind of got put into different, you know, doing different skits and different things as a young person. It's definitely been a part of my upbringing. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Iowa as part of this Indian, small, tight-knit Indian community. And a lot of times, there were a lot of like Hindu heritage folks in that community, and we would have, you know, cultural evenings and events around some of the religious holidays.
Right.
And so they would take all of the children and have them reenact like Bollywood dance numbers and different things like that. So
yeah. So in a way, being part of that community and having kind of those memories, I guess, created the opportunity to be able to like reenact them as a way to remember.
And to stay connected to people and to celebrate shared experience.
Right, yeah. And then how did you end up doing some playwriting? I know you do that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I was always interested in acting. And when I went to college, I started trying to audition for different things and feeling a bit frustrated at some of the stories that I saw put forward and that I didn't really connect to. And so I think out of my own frustration at not seeing stories of people that I related to, I started to write and was really encouraged to do so through an organization called the Asian Arts Initiative. I took like a 3-week autobiographical performance writing workshop.
Oh.
And the reason that I took it was because I saw a notice that said you don't have to be an artist. And I didn't consider myself an artist. Okay, well, I can do this.
Right, yeah.
You know, so I've always loved that and how, you know, I feel like it's so important to encourage the creativity of everybody because we all have such genius and artistic brilliance within us that just gets to be nurtured.
Yeah. So in a way, you were creating space for like the kind of stories you wanted to tell about yourself and maybe like just other things that you were connected with.
Absolutely. And also, I feel like listening was so much a part of that, getting to be in a space of people like me. I mean, other Asian Americans, and getting a chance to share our own experiences was really powerful and the basis for creating art. And what's interesting is that's continued since then, and my entire career is listening as the basis for for creativity and for performance. And that's what Soul Temp Stories is about, is just like having a chance for people to share their stories and be listened to.
Yeah, so do you think that's your favorite thing about acting and playwriting? Just the sharing?
It is part of, actually, I really love it. And I feel like I do it, like anywhere that I go, I'll like be on the bus and I'll start talking to somebody and then listening. And then, I mean, just the stories that people have that we hold and we walk around with are so incredible. Right. And they just kind of spill out whenever there's an opportunity to be listened to. You know, it's very sacred in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I've always been kind of intimidated by acting and theater. So like my only kind of framework for thinking about it is like through seeing like drag performers and how they talk about like just a performance in which you could kind of share more about yourself, but also having this layer of kind of protection or like a screen. And I don't know, I mean, in thinking about that, it seems like that's a very practical way of like interacting and approaching situations in like just regular life.
Definitely.
Yeah. Do you remember any sort of particular experience that stands out for you as an actor or in doing it or in playwriting?
Well, it's kind of blurring the lines of acting and playwriting and just being myself. That, you know, for years, I've kind of seen my work as kind of being an ally to people who were struggling with economic crisis and how to use theater as a way to support platforms for discussion about social issues in our lives. And, you know, I think one thing that kind of started to turn for me was when I faced economic challenges myself and poverty and turning to the people that I had been interviewing. Because I had done a solo play called Capers, which was based on the stories of public housing residents facing the demolition of their neighborhood and were organizing against it.
Yeah.
And, so when I actually lost my housing, I kind of turned to the people that I had interviewed. And I was like, what do I do? And that was a big kind of, I don't know, just a series of turning points for me around seeing myself as part of a larger movement, not as an ally, but as someone directly affected. And I think that also, you know, with the Soul Temp Stories, I've been interviewing different people, but it's coming more from the perspective of also knowing my own story and that is part of this larger tapestry.
No, and you, in with the Soul Temp Stories, you describe it very much in that way. And like, you say it's a multi-year theater project where you question how we heal from racism and poverty. So you're like tackling on very big things. And you come in with like your perspective of how you live these things, but also incorporating narratives that are different or similar in your work.
Right. Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is that I started Soul Temp Stories. It actually started as a different kind of thing where I started to create these comedy sketches, and I called it Ism, a Tragicomedy. And the idea was really to kind of make satire out of things that are really hard. And in doing that, I mean, it was in some ways cathartic, but it also felt, it left me feeling like I was polarizing audiences in ways that, like, there's so many places that different people have different experiences and don't really know how to talk to each other across those differences, particularly around race. And I started to think about, you know, there are different kinds of processes for different moments. You know, sometimes we need to be with people like us to be able to vent and talk about our frustrations, and then other times we need to take that step to kind of talk across the gaps that do divide us towards some kind of healing that does involve like structural changes. You know, there are real reasons that there are these hurts in the world, And how do we address that, not just interpersonally, but recognizing the impact of these larger institutions in how we interact with each other, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, and I think what I wanted to ask you about just art and activism, and I feel that when we combine these sort of questions with art, either through discussing like a story or just looking at a piece of art, we can start creating these links. And I feel that a lot of what your work is doing is creating these links for people and making it tangible and more visible and kind of doing it in an appropriate way, like you say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of what I want to do, you know, because what I realized is when I was doing that, the kind of comedy sketches, I was realizing that I was really angry. And I think it's okay to be angry.
Mm-hmm.
And also I knew that I was in process, like there was something else that I wanted to do and get to. And I realized that part of my own maybe healing, you know, if you want to call it that, was also about getting to really listen, not just to the places that we're hurting, but to the places that people are actively trying to change something for the better. Or,
right.
you know, one of the groups that I've been in touch with a bit was a group, I think I've mentioned before, Chaplains on the Harbor.
Okay.
Out in Aberdeen, Washington. And, you know, some of the stories they're talking about around organizing with people who are poor and white and who are also learning and organizing with, you know, undocumented Latinx folks and Black Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so I'm really interested in the stories of where people are organizing and connecting across different groups that, you know, we've been kind of taught and given misinformation about each other. And so what are the places that people are actually, you know,
creating community to help
one
another.
Yeah, and it's a very transformative thing.
Right, that is, yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you, how did you end up here in D.C. and getting connected with the library? I know we met like earlier this summer and around like talking about the Poor People's Campaign, but maybe just from your perspective, how did you get connected with us?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been in D.C. for a number of years, since like 2002, and I came to D.C. for a job in public radio, actually,
mm-hmm.
And stayed to, you know, do theater and social justice work, connected to community organizing and all sorts of things, and theater-based education type work, a lot of which was supporting young people and other people to create theater about their own lives and things that are relevant to, you know, just what they want to think about and, mm-hmm. and show in the world. And I got connected to D.C. Public Libraries through the curatorial fellow, Nick Petter. And he and I have been knowing each other for a number of years through a similar kind of network of organizers and cultural workers through what is now the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, which is this larger network in the nation of grassroots groups and, you know, theologians and religious leaders, all sorts of folks that are really thinking about and organizing towards the question of abolishing poverty.
Mm-hmm.
As led by the most directly impacted. And so he and I started talking about this because this year is the 50th anniversary of the original Poor People's Campaign, mm-hmm. that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Really pushed for along with other leaders. And so it was a really amazing kind of synchronicity to, you know, talk with Nick about this, as well as, you know, the new campaign has been organizing for a relaunch, for a launch this past May. And so that became also, you know, the D.C. Public Library's focus, along with other moments in 1968, but the original Poor People's Campaign, which not a lot of people know about. And
right.
I think for me, it was amazing to learn more about it, that people, you know, who were from across a lot of different racial groups, you know, came together. You know, 6,000 people camped out in D.C. To protest poverty and created their own tent city. And, you know, with their own sewage system, and Jesse Jackson was the mayor of that town. And
I didn't know that.
I mean, you know, they had a zip code from the post office.
Yeah.
And so to learn about that history in today's world, where we're so deeply polarized around the traumas of, you know, unhealed racism, you know, wow, like, what can we learn from that, and what does that mean for us moving forward today?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's very interesting. I myself only knew about this history very in very little bits. And for me as a librarian working at the library, it was an opportunity to learn more about the local history of DC, kind of a chance to ask people if they remember this. I remember you came by to a coffee and conversation, where we were talking about the refugees, but also where you kind of saw the personalities that come in and out of the library.
And I remember one of the coffee and conversations at Shaw that you led, where a guy, he said, "Oh yeah, I was there. I was there in 1968. I was very young." You know, and he's a veteran, and he does a lot of work, you know, in support of veterans today. Mm-hmm. And so that was really cool to just, you know, happen to go to a coffee and conversation at Shaw, and then turns out there's a few people that remember the Poor People's Campaign of 1968. And I feel like it's also, you know, the way that it gets talked about, not a lot of people know about it, but I feel like for D.C., it is a part of D.C. history, and in a certain way, it seems like it became another neighborhood in D.C. for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was really cool to learn about that perspective.
Right. Yeah, no, and it's a very unique time where people from all sorts of backgrounds came together, seeing past those differences that you described, and create a community, with the bigger lens of healing and creating some change.
Yeah, and you know, one of the stories I collected was with two people who were friends for a little less than 50 years. So, and one of the stories was, you know, one of the friends was in Vietnam, as a soldier for the U.S. Army, and had come back and talked about what that was like, you know, to re-enter society and struggling with homelessness.
Right.
And then his friend, the story of his friend was that at that same time that he was in Vietnam, his friend was protesting the Vietnam War and a part of the Poor People's Campaign, the Resurrection City, that tent city. And so, you know, and talks about the moment that they were pushed out and kind of by the police, and there was tear gas and a lot of arrests, and he, you know, escaped. But it was just a really interesting juxtaposition of, you know, here are these two guys who've been close friends for nearly 50 years and talking about two different sides in a way of that experience in 1968.
Yeah, that's very powerful. Anu, we have some of those stories to share with listeners today. Did you want to start out with any one of those?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it might be really great to start with Vanessa Nosey's clip. She is a member of the San Carlos Apache tribe that's in Arizona. And they're... community, their tribe has been an active part of the Poor People's Campaign.
Okay.
And I met her during the 40 days in D.C. This summer.
Okay, let's take a listen to Vanessa Noisy.
My oldest daughter, we had her coming of age ceremony on a mountain called Zitlan Chosian, which is known as Mount Graham, which is outside of jurisdiction. And we've been fighting for this mountain for over 30 years. So she was the first Apache person, Apache girl, to have her coming of age ceremony in over 150 years on this mountain. Praying, that's an action. That's a nonviolence through action. So what we're doing as Apache Stronghold, protecting not only our religious rights as indigenous people, we're also trying to protect the earth. And we're doing this for the people. Yusin, on the creator, he knows. You know, because it's been too long that we've been the dust swept underneath the rug. You know, now we're lifting that rug and saying, no, you have to deal with us. You have to hear us. You have to hear our voices, our cries. Because what we're trying to protect you too.
Well, that was Vanessa Noisy, a member of the San Carlos Apache tribe in Arizona. And that was recorded by Anu. Anu, you said you recorded that during the 40 days of action. Can you tell us about those days and where you were when you recorded that interview with Vanessa?
Yeah, so the New Poor People's Campaign launched their, national campaign on Mother's Day of this year, and to do 40 days of direct action, civil disobedience, rallies, teach-ins, all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And it was coordinated in up to 40 states. Might be a little less than that, but, a varying kinds of activity. And every week there was a certain set of activities in all these states. So in D.C., they had a number of activities, and one of them was, a teach-in around various things. And also, actually, they ended up getting a congressional hearing with a bunch of senators at the Capitol. And so Vanessa Noisy was there, along with a number of other people from the campaign. So I interviewed her during the time that she came for that congressional hearing, which was also extremely powerful to be at.
Yeah.
And that was great to get her perspective. I'm still in my mind. I'm remembering earlier that day before I interviewed her, where she and others spoke to Senator Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker, and a number of others. And it was just an incredible experience to see these organizers, who are facing so many, such poverty and so many things. And these senators on the other end of the, table, saying, well, what do you want us to do? Tell us what you need us to do.
Yeah.
It was really, really something.
Yeah, no, I got a chance to listen to a larger part of that interview, and just to listen to Vanessa's passion and how she really describes things through her own perspective is really eye-opening. But when I remember those 40 days while you were here and how busy things were. You guys, the campaign was had a lot of events throughout the day, rallies, just meetings where people reflected and came together. Did you have any sort of framework or process that you laid out for yourself in conducting these interviews? Or I guess what was the goal in doing the interviews and you're what were you hoping to bring out in them?
Yeah, I mean, this was originally part of a proposal I sent to not only DC Public Libraries, but other places as well. And my idea was to create short plays inspired by the Poor People's Campaign. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what that meant, what it would look like. I just knew that it would require a lot of listening to people on the ground, that are leaders in their communities, that are organizing, and really learn, getting a chance to collect what are their experiences, lessons learned, some of the challenges, and their vision for moving forward. And so during the 40 days, the proposal, it kind of changed and morphed into, many different things. So I was kind of shaping it and reshaping it along the way to see what really fit and made sense for that time period. And I knew that creating short plays, for me, playwriting is a much longer process than 40 days. It's just how I've figured out to work. However, interviewing people and listening to them and creating short excerpts of their interviews as audio stories is something that felt a lot more doable within a shorter period of time. And so that's how it turned into that. And the Soul Tent, actually, you know, it's called Soul Tent Stories. The Soul Tent is in reference to the cultural center that was at the 1968 Resurrection City. And right. It was basically the tent that, you know, people in that encampment came to share experiences of struggle and music and culture and stories across their lines of difference. So, you know, you had folks who were indigenous, Latinx, African heritage, white, coming together and sharing culture, sharing art. And so I thought that was a really nice ode to that, not of the divides, but like how we're kind of moving towards something bigger. Mm-hmm. Not dismissing our divides for sure, because part of that healing and organizing together is about recognizing how we've been pitted against each other.
Right.
So that's how the name Soul Tent Stories came about. Yeah. And then I started to just interview people, and it felt kind of nonstop. And I remember one time waking up early in the morning, and I just started to cry because it was so beautiful, the stories that people were sharing. Mm-hmm. And I knew that part of that was not because I was coming in as an outsider. I was coming in as part of this. Like, this is also mine, too. Mm. And I think that shifts something for people when who's listening to them is someone who's like, right. I'm with you.
Yeah. Well, we have another recording, a short clip. Did you want to present Elijah's next, Anu?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Elijah.
Yeah.
Elijah Alexander, also known as Nature Boy, and he comes to the Coffee and Conversation talks at Mount Pleasant Library.
Okay.
And yeah, so this is a clip of Elijah, who's a DC resident.
Great. Thank you.
According to the Constitution, the taxes are specifically for defense and for the general welfare. Defense, not offense as we are doing, but defense. Any taxes not used for that ought to be used for the general welfare, which means making sure no people are without house, clothes, food, healthcare, period. So every person in any leadership position in government has committed perjury for refusing to follow that oath that they took. Protecting the United States Constitution. You know, to protect it means you have to implement. It would imprison the oppressors. But for the general population, it would give them the liberty they had never experienced in their life.
Well, that was Elijah Alexander, who is a D.C. resident, talking to Anu. Was that recorded at Mount Pleasant Library, Anu?
Nearby Mount Pleasant Library in Elijah's home, actually.
Okay. Yeah. And how did you met Elijah?
Well, you know, I had met him because I had gone to a couple of the coffee and conversations. And actually, one of them, some of the people from the kind of coordinating council of the Poor People's Campaign had come to visit the Coffee and Conversation and to also explain, you know, just talk with people and talk a little bit about the Hunger Wall, which was the big mural that was also being housed there at Mount Pleasant, along with the Soul Tent installation, which...
Right.
Soul Tent Stories is a part of this was a part of this traveling exhibit of that Nick and other librarians worked on, that traveled to through, you know, four different libraries, including Mount Pleasant. And so it was great to have the, you know, installation, which in and of itself was kind of an ode to the structures that people lived in 1968.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, in thinking about the Soul Tent, I think that physical space is very powerful. I got to see it when it was at the Funk Parade, and just seeing how people interacted with the space and learning about the past, but then also how it kind of invited, it invites everyone to kind of share and participate by just like walking through it. But were you part of building and constructing that tent, or were you just there and sharing and capturing the stories?
Yeah, no, I helped share and capture stories. You know, I helped transport some of the materials a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that was definitely designed by Nick and built by him and Maggie Gilmore and a few other folks. And but then there were other librarians also involved in creating programming around it. I think Wanda Jones over at the Dorothy Height Benning Library,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, a few other folks.
Well, one of the things one of the opportunities that we had as librarians in working on this project and reflecting on 1968 is a lot of things that came out in conversations was thinking of our work as being on the front lines and what that means. You know, like at the library, like we do programs that really can affect people, or we can also create programs that may not be as inclusive as we think. But also this kind of, in working with you on a personal level, made me think of how like art and dialogue can have a really big impact and just how you relate and live in the community. So thanks for that, Anu.
Yeah. Yeah, no. It was amazing to come to your coffee and conversations because they were so lively and...
Yeah.
No, you know, and also facilitating those, it takes its own set of skills.
Right.
How do you create a space where people can share and listen to each other, that no one person dominates, but also it's comfortable enough for people to, you know, deepen connection or insight with each other.
Yeah.
And so that was quite remarkable to see that.
I guess for me as a librarian, all of this work and has reminded me to like, or challenged me to try and look for ways to really represent the community that I'm working with and to advocate for their needs or and like you, to be kind of something or someone that can help facilitate something, a dialogue, a connection that can lead to like change in like on a very local scale around like the library and the community. Well, Anu, do you want to listen to Leslie Boyd's clip next? Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about Leslie Boyd.
Yeah, well, Leslie Boyd, what's interesting about Leslie Boyd, there are many things that are interesting about Leslie Boyd, but I met her because each week of the campaigns, 40 Days of Action, had a different theme. And I met her at the rally on the Capitol that was for healthcare and a healthy planet. That was the theme for that week. And she'd come from North Carolina to share her story, which you'll hear in the clip. But she and I both were speaking at the rally. Mm. And that was very, very powerful to share my own story. And then also, after that, connect with her and have her share hers.
All right. This is Leslie Boyd.
I was mother to Mike Danforth. He was born on my 22nd birthday, and he had a birth defect that left him very vulnerable to cancer of the colon. We did not know when he decided to take a year off of college that that would mean he could never get insurance again. He applied for disability. It took 37 months for it to come through. His first check came 9 days after he died. This is what we're doing to people in this country now. We're starving them. We're letting them die from preventable causes. We're forcing poor people into the military. I'm calling it the poverty draft. Society is a tapestry. When you remove most of the threads, you can't fix it by putting just one back. I'm not afraid of anything anymore because you took the most precious thing from me that could ever be taken from anyone, and that was my child. I have to stand with my brothers and sisters who stand for education and the environment and voting rights. All of these things need to be restored, every last one. And I will not give up.
Great. That was Leslie Boyd. Thanks, Anu, for sharing that clip with us. No, that's really powerful. I think one of the things that we previously talked about, I remember, was people in this campaign were willing to be arrested. They were willing to do a lot of things to be heard. And Leslie on the clip talks about just having no fear after losing her child. Maybe can you tell us maybe more instances of how you saw this throughout the campaign?
Yeah, she had gotten arrested that day, and I did not. And I actually, it wasn't until, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to, because I wanted, I think sometimes when we talk about some of the more visible aspects of civil disobedience or marching and that getting arrested, I didn't want it to be something that I was doing to look cool or something. Right. I wanted it to have some kind of deep significance and be very clear and intentional about why I was doing it and what it was connected to and all sorts of things like that. I don't know. Yeah. So I was watching and listening to people, and then the last week, I decided that I wanted to participate. And they say that, when more people are getting arrested together, it's actually safer for everybody because it's a lot more for the police to handle. It's, so at that point, when we'd gotten arrested, the police had set up the tables on the, just on the grass to kind of process everybody. And one of the things that really struck me in making the decision to do that was talking with a man named Tommy Tackett, who's with Michigan Welfare Rights Organization out in Detroit, Michigan, where they've been protesting for the right to water, to clean water, among other things. And one of the things he said was he said it was a very deeply spiritual decision to decide to get arrested for this. And it was very moving to hear him talk about what it meant, what it was. It was a part of something much bigger, and his own experience, his own kind of politicized process of coming to this work. I think what was most profound was meeting people from all stages of life.
Right. Yeah.
That were coming to this, and it was, one woman who said she was from Flint, Michigan, and she works with Tommy, and she said, I had twins. I was pregnant with twins, and they died because of the lead in the water.
Right.
And she said, I'm not doing this for any other purpose than, there was such rage and such righteousness. Mm-hmm. And to be kind of led and fueled by this strong sense of purpose and what is right and what needs to be righted was very powerful to hear from people.
And one of the things for me that really resonated in looking at the campaign was just kind of how much this love and love for community kind of kept resonating over and over and over, versus like, yeah, there's a lot of pain and that we go through, but what's driving, what drove and drives this campaign is one out of love and not pain. It's about healing and making something constructive and positive out of that pain that we might have gone through and turning it into love. Would you agree with that, Anu?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's something that we get to be reminded of and deepen and keep acting towards again and again. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of times, maybe particularly in the U.S., there's this kind of quest for upward mobility and this kind of individual pursuit,
right,
that as if happiness and everything we want is an individual pursuit. And it really isn't. Our happiness and our what's good actually does come from a sense of community and being with people and knowing that we're part of something larger. And that was definitely echoed and reaffirmed for me, even personally, being connected to this. The last day, you know, on the rally, someone had said something someone I didn't know had said something kind of hurtful towards me. And I didn't know them. It was a bit of a racist thing they'd said. And I remember feeling really, really hurt by it. And I had had this amazing time up until that moment, you know. Yeah. And but then in getting to process it and talk about it with other people, I realized that, people are going to say and do all sorts of things. I mean, we all have our struggles and, you know, the idea of working together across differences, stuff is going to bubble up. Mm-hmm. But I was able to recognize that I had built such strong relationships with people that, you know, had I not, I might have just been like, oh, well, forget all of this, I'll walk away. But no, I mean, there's something here that's bigger than that, and also people that connect and understand me. I don't know, I just noticed I experienced that sense of connection and community that...
You have like a very deep and strong link with all these people around you that you've done this work with.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Anu, we have one more clip. Paul Pumphrey. And tell us who Paul Pumphrey is.
Paul Pumphrey is with the Maryland State Chapter of the Poor People's Campaign. He's a former Black Panther. He's done so many things. He's lived in D.C. for a while. He's in Maryland now. And this was an interview I did with him. Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
If I come and steal your pocketbook, you don't have any money. But the reason why you have any money is not because you were poor, it's because I robbed you. If someone describes you as being poor, then it takes away the responsibility of who robbed you. You're not looking for a cause for why a person is now poor.
The day the king was killed, I decided that I needed to do more to help with the Poor People's Campaign.
We were spending, at that time, hundreds of billions of dollars to finance a war to kill a group of poor people all the way over in Asia, while at the same time, there were poor people here who needed to have a number of things, and those needs weren't being met. The original idea of Dr. King was that we were going to be here until the government changed. And so if this particular campaign can pick up the mantle and finish the work that was started, this country and this world would be a much better place.
Great. That was Paul Pumphrey. And Anu, before we wrap up, I guess, can you remind us about the platform for the campaign itself? We've heard lots of various themes in the clips, but maybe if you want to sum it up for us.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a few different things. One is there are four different themes or kind of issues that the campaign is wanting to address, which are quite big, to address and end systemic racism, systemic poverty, environmental devastation, and the war economy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the reason that they want to address and kind of end all four of those things is because you can't really end one without the other. The way our world has become, everything is so interlinked. So it really is, in a very concrete way, the oppression of any one person is connected to the oppression of anyone else, and ending all of it is actually where we need to work towards. And so they also have, they came out with an audit, which they did in collaboration with the Institute for Policy Studies, which is a D.C.-based think tank. And that was to kind of really look at what is the state of poverty in the United States today. And they called it the Souls of Poor Folk Audit, which was in honor of W.E. Du Bois' The Souls of Black Folk, his seminal work. So, those are a couple things. And the platform is a lot more detailed and is on the website.
Anu, thanks for sharing these with us and talking to me today. What's next for the Soul Tent Stories?
Well, what's next is hosting a series of listening parties, which essentially are to play clips like the ones we heard and more. I have about 20 total so far. And so to share 20 clips, as well as have a storytelling workshop where people get to share and discuss what it means to them in their own lives. So I have actually, it looks like two that will be coming up. One Sunday, the 23rd, at Bloom Bars at 4 p.m. in D.C. And Monday, the 24th at 6:30 p.m. at Anacostia Library.
Oh, great. Well, thanks again, Anu.
And thank you so much.
Enjoy your afternoon.
All right, take care.
Yeah, bye. This has been an episode of DC Public Library Presents on Full Service Radio, broadcasted live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Join the DC Public Library for its fourth annual Uncensored DC Banned Book Scavenger Hunt. Starting today, hundreds of banned books will be hidden at various locations around the city. The theme for this year's scavenger hunt is Words Ignite, the Literature of Activism. Books are wrapped in a special cover. For clues to where to find the books, look for the hashtag UncensoredDC on social media. Visit dclibrary.org to learn more about the library. Follow us on Instagram at DC Public Library and Twitter at DCPL. Download this show wherever you listen to your podcast by searching for Full Service Radio. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.